Hello, hello, and a very warm welcome to the Steps to Investing podcast, your home for stock market news and ideas to help you beat high inflation by getting you investing for a better return. I'm Marcus De Silva. Another big show for you today. Of course, I hope you are all very well. Today in our interview, we're going to speak to Myron Jobson. He is the Senior Personal Finance Analyst at Interactive Investor, the UK's second largest platform. We have had him on the podcast before, lovely chap, and he's going to be taking us through all the highlights, basically, of the autumn statement, which happened a week ago, and what it means for you, mainly private investors. If you want more of this, there's also my blog on the Steps site, which I released last Friday, that adds some further detail to. Elsewhere in the podcast, we've got a fair bit on the UK and markets as new economic data is released. And of course, as we had the autumn statement, we're also going to be speaking a bit about oil. In our explainer, I'm going to go through what happened with the collapse of the cryptocurrency exchange FTX, a really interesting story there. And then finally, in companies, we're going to hop through the main headlines and look at Twitter, Disney, Shell, and Manchester United. Please, please, please share this with friends. Go on, do it right now. We need the support as always. And of course, many thanks to our sponsors, Janus Henderson Investors, for their support, helping us educate and inform private investors. All right, let's start with markets and a little bit of a rundown with what Steps has been speaking to Hargreaves Lansdown about, some of those key events in the markets over the fortnight. And there were a few themes that emerged from conversations. I'm going to start with oil. So over the fortnight, we've been seeing that the price has been falling. It's gone over the 2 weeks from sort of mid-90s to around mid-80s today. That's for Brent crude, which is just a sort of standardized benchmark. And this is around concerns for the demand of oil. And mainly this is stemming out of China because, once again, we've been seeing COVID cases spiking, so more lockdowns, and therefore this sort of slowing down of this enormous, enormous economy and its thunderous appetite for energy. So that's why it's sort of squishing demand downwards and therefore the price. Interestingly, we saw a Monday it fall even further. It dipped to around $82 a barrel. And it was very volatile trading. And that was because the sort of rumour mill got going. And it emerged that there was a rumour that OPEC was going to increase production at their next meeting, which of course, you know, opens the taps. That's why you see the weakness in the price. We then heard from the energy minister in Saudi, who poured cold water on that idea and said, actually, what are you talking about? We're more likely to do the opposite, given these sorts of this sort of impact on demand that we're seeing at the moment. Nonetheless, it was a bit of a respite for consumers and companies. It's being a big part of the inflation problem. The other big part in the energy markets, of course, is gas. And European gas prices have stabilised. We have fortunately had a winter that's proving mild so far, and storage had been filled quite well actually over the year, really, in order to try to prepare for this. So, you know, that's good at least. Still, gas is around five times higher than it was 18 months ago. So it's a big part of that inflationary problem stems from those prices. UK, well, there were various bits of data released and all eyes were on the autumn statement, alongside no doubt probably a few prayer vigils as well, hoping for no repeats of that disastrous Trussonomics mini budget. I mean, what a farce that was. So in an about turn to the previous administration's sort of sugar rush of tax cuts, Mr. Hunt stepped up to the dispatch box, painted a grim picture for the UK economy, according to figures from the Independent Office of Budget Responsibility, the OBR, and outlined plans to fill a rather large £55 billion fiscal hole with tax rises and austerity. I'm going to go through the detail in just a sec in my interview with Myron Jobson from Interactive Investor. All told, though, markets reacted pretty calmly. They were relieved that the Chancellor gave what was seen as a pretty sensible statement. He was obviously bringing back financial stability. The criticisms, though, were that there was a bit of a lack of long-term vision for growth in the UK. You know, we could do with lots of investment. There's seen as a big UK productivity issue here. It's languished for decades. The other is workers as well. With the lack of workers, companies are sort of in the midst of this bun fight, and that's increasing wages and costs at a time when other costs, inputs like energy, are pretty punchy. On to the data releases. We sort of saw the two key bits. The first is that inflation is sizzling, really, at the moment. The latest reading is 11.1%. The worst offenders are food and energy. So that's pretty harsh. It means the Bank of England are very likely at their December meeting to raise interest rates once again. Markets are sort of guessing 0.5% or 0.75%. But they're also predicting rates will be between 4.5% and 4.75% by the middle of next year. We also heard some economic data as well. And between June and September, the UK economy shrank. So two quarters would be an official recession. We've had one. It, you know, judging from the comments from the OBR, it seems as if we're going to have another one. So we're probably in the middle of a recession. That's actually what the OBR were saying as well. Across the pond, we saw some minutes from the last meeting of Fed officials. This is called the Federal Open Market Committee. And there seemed to be quite a lot of agreement that higher rates were starting to bite into inflation and have an effect on it, as they would hope. Also, there were you know, some concerns rising around the fact that their actions were likely to tip the US into a recession. So, of course, investors, traders see this, they read this, and they go, oh, okay, they're foreseeing that there's going to be a softening of stance there by the Fed, and that hopefully that will start to reduce the pace of rises or lead to smaller ones, etc. So that's naturally led to a bit of a rally over in the US market as well. Finally, we had the collapse of a crypto exchange, FTX, which certainly caused waves across the whole crypto asset market and a big drop in value. So I'm going to explain a lot more on that in just a sec. All in all, the S&P 500 is up 1.79% to 4,027 points. The FTSE 100 is up 1.37% to 7,476 points. Europe's Stoxx 600 is up 2.09% to 441 points. And the Nikkei 225 is up 3.41% to 28,383 points. All right, let's get on to this rather fascinating story around FTX, which has sort of gone into meltdown and caused its founder to lose more money in the space of a short period than any man in history. So let's go through it all. So what is FTX? Well, it's one of the world's largest cryptocurrency exchanges. It has some pretty risky trading options on its platform that are not legal in the US, hence its base in the Bahamas. But it's more than that. It's actually quite a complex business that's split into four areas. We've got two exchanges, one in the US and one for US customers and the other one for international ones, where rules can be a bit more lax. There's also a hedge fund that trades crypto assets for profit, and there's a venture capital arm that invests in other businesses. How does it make money? Well, mainly through the exchanges, by taking a cut when you buy crypto from normal money. They're known as fiat currencies. The big bucks come from the Wild West or the International Trading Exchange, where pretty complex, pretty leveraged trades can be made and will earn the platform big commissions. What's happened? Well, it's filed for bankruptcy protection following the collapse of a bailout deal with Binance, another enormous platform and its competitor, which would have saved it. Its chief and founder, Sam Bankman-Fried, was ousted, and the new chief, bankruptcy specialist, John J. Ray, I may add the third, not one, not two, but the third, came out and said he'd never seen such a complete failure of corporate control, in his words. As the man who helped manage the aftermath of Enron in 2001, that's a pretty big statement. So why did it collapse? Well, there is a link between the exchange and the group's hedge fund, Alameda, which there really shouldn't have been. A leaked document showed that the hedge fund was holding a lot of FTX's own coin, FTT, and it prompted a leak of this. I think it was on a site called Coinbase. Prompted the rival exchange Binance to sell a fairly large holding in FTT. When that started to spiral downwards, it then caused a run on the exchange. This information was out. It seemed like the platform was doing some pretty dodgy things. So the customers started panicking and taking out their cash. FTX didn't have the money to pay their customers. And although Binance looked at bailing them out, in the end it said it couldn't, because the company was in a complete financial mess. What emerged was that FTX couldn't accept a lot of wire transfers from its customers, so the money would be sent to the hedge fund, Alameda, and FTX would credit company accounts. What Alameda was then not doing was passing the funds on to FTX, but rather trading with those funds and ultimately losing them. So how's the market reacted? Well, a bit of a meltdown. Almost exactly 1 year ago, Bitcoin touched nearly $65,000 a coin. We're now at $16,500 a coin. Finally, what does this mean for crypto? Well, in come the regulators, I think. Crypto assets were meant to be a broader experiment that proved government oversight over finance is actually pretty sinister. With little recourse over what's happened at the FTX exchange, I bet some of its customers wish there had been. Okay, on to some company headlines. What have we seen? Twitter, well, I'm sure a lot of you are following this. The super engineer Elon Musk seems to be having some big battles at the companies. He's most recently made changes to make the working culture more hardcore, and that's led to another exodus of employees, which is coming on top of a layoff that had already binned half of its workforce. Lots of users have been downloading data for fear of collapse. There are questions, with so many engineers not there, how the platform will continue to function, especially considering that it receives just loads and loads and loads of cyber attacks every single day. Moving on, Disney, Tale of Two Bobs. Disney surprised lots of people by announcing its chief, Bob Chapek, was leaving, and that its longtime former 15-year chief, that makes him sound like he was 15 years old, he was there for 15 years, Bob Iger, would be returning to give the company some fresh strategic direction. It has some good businesses, some good assets. Its theme park business is pretty resilient, but there are fears, actually, particularly in that one, that the cost of living crisis may eat into the revenues there. Its streaming business has also been doing very well. It made some very smart acquisitions a decade ago, and it's really growing its subscriber base strongly. But as with all of those types of businesses, it's hemorrhaging cash. Moving on, Shell. So off the back of the Chancellor's Jeremy Hunt's extension and increase to the windfall tax to help pay for the energy price cap, Shell has warned that it may lead to a cut in its investments in the North Sea and its green projects as well. Whether this materializes and is just sort of a bit of a public pressure tactic is another thing, but public opinion is certainly not on the side of the energy companies. BP made similar threats early in the year and they didn't come to fruition. And the outgoing Shell CEO said the burden to help the poorest in society should fall on the side of the sector. So we'll see whether or not this pressures Mr. Hunt to do a U-turn. Finally, the owners of Man U have indicated their intention to sell, coming in hot on the heels of an explosive Piers Morgan interview with Cristiano Ronaldo. Potential interested buyers include Sir Jim Ratcliffe and David Beckham. It will come at a price, though. Even with the shares in New York shooting higher on the news and an implied value of $2.5 billion based on the price of those shares, it's expected to fetch somewhere nearer in the region of $4.5 billion, given the level of interest. Okay, on to our interview with Myron Jobson. So, last week we heard from the Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, and it was a pretty grim statement, to be honest, from him in the autumn statement. So what I wanted to do this week was to speak to a chap that we've had on the podcast before from Interactive Investor. They're the second largest investing platform in the UK, and he's going to run through everything, well, pretty much everything, particularly the things that matter to investors that was in that autumn statement. So I'd like to welcome Myron Jobson. Myron, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
So let's start off top line. What were the kind of key things that were said in the autumn statement?
Well, I mean, top line, we are all going to pay more in taxes over the coming years until probably 2028, to be precise, and if not beyond that. I think the word that's been, you know, pushed about by the media following and before the statement is fiscal drag, simply because Jeremy Hunt confirmed in his autumn statement that various tax thresholds, so income tax, inheritance tax, for example, will be frozen until 2028. So what that means is as people, as inflation continues to go up and as wages continue to go up, the freezing of these tax thresholds mean that people will be paying more in tax in real terms. And this is a stealth way of the government actually getting money from taxpayers. And I suppose the reason why this is happening is because we have a £55 billion black budget and black hole in public finances. And the government is desperately trying to find a way of plugging this black hole as the cost of borrowing continues to rise.
Oh dear, yeah, pretty grim, wasn't it? So shall we go then to, okay, so lots of taxes to pay. What the government are trying to apply is a bit of this thing called a fiscal drag, which is a very economics-y kind of term, and they're trying to plug this big hole that suddenly emerged in the public purse. Shall we start a little bit with the forecast, actually? So we have the Office of Budget Responsibility. It's an independent institution, and it gives its view, and it often comes in lockstep with the Chancellor's statement. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And they said that Britain's GDP won't return to pre-pandemic levels until 2024, which is not great. And this is not great in particular because other G7 countries, the top seven economies in the world, have already seen their GDP return to pre-pandemic levels.
So we're the worst of all G7s.
We are the worst of all G7 countries, which isn't great. And so, yeah, that's not going to return back until 2024. And next year, GDP will actually fall by 1.4%, which isn't great. And we already heard from the Bank of England before the statement saying that we are entering the longest recession since over 100 years ago, which is very worrying, especially to our public, to our personal finances at a time of the cost of living crunch. So it's just, it was just more doom
just
and gloom.
Really grisly,
it's not great, yeah.
So a recession is when you have two consecutive quarters or longer of negative growth. So it means that the economy is shrinking.
That's
And here what we're going to see is that we're already in one now, right? And it's going to last for all of next year as well. So that's why it's such a long recession.
Exactly. And during recessions, unemployment usually increases, unfortunately, right, as business struggle to stay afloat with all, you know, the things that happen to economy with a recession. And we have all been made aware that unemployment has actually gone down recently post the pandemic, because it's been such a great time, great market for job seekers. But yeah, with recession, that typically the reverse happens. And so it's hard in this cost of living crisis, people are struggling to afford the bare necessities, and then we've got this looming recession, which means that unemployment might go up. So it's just not the greatest outlook, to be honest.
Okay, so pretty grisly economy. That then means that the government can't take in as much money as well, and things just sort of, it just doesn't work as well from a finance kind of point of view in terms of the government.
Yeah.
As far as it's concerned, so it has to then do things like raise taxes and tighten the belts and things like
exactly austerity, right? Exactly, especially with disposable income set to fall at its fastest pace next year since the 1950s.
Well, actually that's a good point. I've got figures here. Disposable income will drop by 4.3%.
Yeah,
so that's pretty grim. Okay, fine. So that's the kind of bigger picture. And then what we found within that was that there were certain details that, of course, went along with it, and the Chancellor was sort of picking upon certain things in order to try and raise those taxes or tighten those belts. So let's have a little look what it means for households. Let's start with wages. What happened there?
Yeah, so the government, it's a legally enforceable minimum wage for people over the age of 23, has increased from £9.50 to £10.42 an hour, and this will come into force from next April.
Right, okay. So we've seen quite a nice increase then for those on minimum wage.
Yeah.
But I suppose those are the ones that are affected the hardest as well by the cost
exactly.
of living crisis, right?
Exactly. They spend more, those on the lower end of the income spectrum spend more on the bare necessities, such as energy, household energy, such as food. And the harsh reality is with inflation expected to remain high for quite some time, these costs are still going to hack away at their budgets, at their monthly budgets, which means they have just less, they have to make stark sacrifices to remain financially afloat.
And then what do we see in terms of the energy bills? Is there any help there? Because obviously we've been seeing this as being a big part of the inflationary problem this year, is that particularly gas as well on the back of the Ukraine war, but also pretty high oil prices as well. And that's been a big thing that sort of fed through into homes.
Huge, yeah, huge. So the government, we all know that government through the energy guarantee scheme froze the price of energy to around £2,500 per year for a typical household. So initially on the ill-fated mini budget that was supposed to be in place for 2 years, but it was simply too expensive for the government to commit to. And so Jeremy Hunt didn't then announce in the autumn statement that this guarantee will be until April, and from after April it will be less generous. So the cap will mean that the typical household won't spend around £3,000 instead of £2,500 on the old cap on energy bills. But there will be some more support for those, well, the more vulnerable members of society. So for people who are on benefits, they'll receive a one-off £900 cost of living payment. And for less well-off pensioners, they'll receive £300 cost of living payment. And for those who are disabled or receive some sort of disability benefit, they'll receive £150 to help with this kind of cost of living crisis that just continues to rage on.
So it was too expensive for the government. That's interesting, because it was one of those things that I read that the cap had actually reduced the risk of recession to some extent, because it was such a big factor in the way that consumers, you know, it crimps consumers and the spare cash that they have to spend in the economy. You would have thought they'd be sort of keen to maybe keep that level going, but I guess it must have been really unsustainable.
No, it's just unsustainable, isn't it? Mm. It's just this 55 billion fiscal black hole in the public's finance. And it's quite interesting because, you know, I want to quickly talk about the mini budget. The whole idea of the ill-fated mini budget under the previous Chancellor was that spending, you can stimulate economic growth through spending, through tax cuts, i.e. given that taxpayers put more pounds back into their pockets in order to spend more money on businesses, you know, which again increase, it stimulates economic growth. This budget, this statement, it does the opposite. And I suppose the government recognises the need to spend responsibly again because of the amount of debt it racked up through coronavirus support measure schemes and also cost of living support measure schemes. And with interest rates only seem to be going up to help rein in rampant inflation, the government's very aware of its debts, and it could continue to inflate. So I think it's taken a view now that harsh sacrifices has been made now, affecting our own personal finance, which means we'll feel poorer as a result, in order to get the UK economy back on the even keel. Whether this will work remains to be seen, but it just means that life might not be as comfortable for many people as it was certainly before the pandemic.
Okay, and the big worry is presumably not just that sort of fiscal hole, but inflation is the big thing that they're trying to sort of crimp as well, with this kind of, you know, turning the screws on the consumers as well.
Exactly, and even with inflation, I mean, it's really difficult with inflation. Of course, you have factors such as the devastating war in Ukraine, which continues to go on. Unfortunately, you have there's still some post-COVID supply bottlenecks in place, and also the tight labour market where there's just a dearth of talent out there. And what employers are finding that they have to do is to up wages, which actually does fuel inflation in turn to actually attract the best talent. And these factors are quite persistent and are difficult to actually overcome, it seems. And so, yeah, that's definitely fueling inflation.
So this may not work. This may not actually help really with the inflationary problem in the short term. Do you think it will?
You know, when you look at history, when you think about what's been done to stimulate economic growth, it's typically more spending and tax cuts. We'll see. The OBR has costed. And the measures, the announcements, the policies that are announced in the statement. So we'll see if it actually ends up making financial sense to have this period of austerity. You know, many of us will remember the period following the financial crash, what, over 10 years ago, like maybe 13 years ago now. And that was difficult for some. But with these support measures that have been announced, I mentioned the cost of living additional top up, in addition to the other measures that were announced earlier this year, such as the £400 energy bill discount and the council tax discount, and all sorts. There's also the household support fund, which is distributed by local councils to really help those who are at the most disadvantaged through this cost of living scheme. Hopefully these schemes will help people who desperately need it to survive, I suppose, this cost of living storm.
And we also heard as well, in terms of this, going back to the energy price cap, that it's going to be funded as well. We're going to see increased funding from the energy companies themselves, right?
Yeah. So energy companies will have to pay 25% worth of tax on their profits. Well, initially, that's what they've paid, but that'll go up to 35%. And yeah, this was pretty much known before the statement, because it was leaked in the press, like most of these measures and policies, weeks in advance. But again, that will help fund some of these support measures and also help, close the financial black hole in the public's finances.
Okay, right. So it's going to be partly paid for by those energy companies as well. We also, getting onto income taxes as well. What have we seen there?
Yeah, so when it comes to income taxes, the additional rate of tax, the threshold for that has been brought down from £150,000 to £125,000, which means more and more people will be paying the high rates of tax. And combine that with fiscal drag, with the freezing of the income tax and the higher rate tax thresholds until 2028, that means more and more people will be paying more in tax. And also, I should perhaps mention national insurance threshold. So that's the other side of income tax, which a lot of people forget about. So that also has been frozen. So the threshold went up to 12,570 back in July, and that's to align with the income tax threshold. So that will also remain frozen to 2028.
Okay, because when we talk about frozens, you sort of mentioned it in this kind of context of fiscal drag. It's kind of like a stealth tax, isn't it? It's a kind of stealthy way of kind of like trying
to increase taxes. Because it is cheeky of the government. It's a cheeky way of getting more tax pounds into HMRC's coffers, really, because politically, no government will say, right, we're increasing taxes, but this is just a stealth way of doing so. It's just because when these thresholds are frozen, it's what I was saying earlier, when these thresholds are frozen, inflation doesn't remain static, wage inflation doesn't remain static. So over the years, more and more of us will be paying a higher amount in taxes.
Yeah, so particularly at the moment as well, when you're seeing the price of things moving up quite quickly, then that has an even bigger effect in terms of how it impacts us as well when you freeze these thresholds.
Oh, exactly. I mean, disposable incomes are falling rapidly as a result. And you know, imagine if you're highly leveraged, as in you have a high amount of debt on your name, you're getting hit from all corners, you know, from fiscal drag. They can't see my air quotes, I just realized. Don't do air quotes when you're doing the podcast. But yeah, fiscal drag, and you got inflation, rising inflation, and it's very sticky inflation. So things like food inflation, the amount we pay for food is going through the roof. Energy bill inflation, that's gone through the roof also. And then you have increase in interest rates, which means borrowing costs have increased. And so this is just chipping away at people's wealth, just making it hard, really, for a lot of people.
Okay. And then, getting on to probably the big story for those who are investing.
Yeah.
We saw some big changes here, which was very interesting. Let's start with dividends. So do you want to explain what you normally would pay with dividends?
Yeah, so normally we have a tax-free allowance of £2,000 with dividends, but on the changes announced in the autumn statement, this will go down to £1,000 for the next tax year, so 2023 to 2024 tax year. And this will be reduced again to £500 in the following tax years, so 2024 and 2025 tax year. So that means the dividends allowance amount that investors can earn on dividends they get from their investments held outside tax-efficient wrappers like ISAs, will be reduced from £2,000 to £500,
right, okay.
Just a couple of years.
Okay. And yeah, we're going to get onto the wrappers in just a sec. So the other, I suppose, the side of this, you're investing and, you know, you can get income from things like dividends.
Yeah.
You can also get capital growth. And you get taxed on this too. And this has also been hit in a big way, hasn't
big
it?
Way. You know, so the current allowance, tax-free allowance is 12,300, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And it's gone down to, to £6,000 in 6 months. Can you believe? And then it will be further cut to £3,000 from April 2024. So that's a huge reduction in the tax-free allowance. And that's going to affect a lot of people, landlords, for example, when it comes to, when they want to sell off their buy-to-let properties, they'll be hit massively. And also, I don't think a lot of people think about this, but people who inherit homes from parents, for example, it might affect them. Not a lot of people understand that when you inherit a house, any uptick in value from the point in which you inherit it could be subject to capital gains tax. And with the capital gains tax allowance going down quite significantly, a lot of people will be hit by the tax.
Okay. And property runs at slightly different rates, isn't it? Depending on, so in terms of capital gains for things like shares.
Oh, yeah. So it's like 28% for residential property, and for, you know, things like shares, it's 20%.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And that's for the higher rates, I think.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Exactly. That's higher rate.
The basic rate is 10 and 18.
Yeah. That's
basically.
Right.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So some pretty big changes there. And I think there is a lesson in this, isn't there? There's a way of sheltering yourself from those sorts of tax rises.
Exactly. ISAs, you know, if you can, if you haven't maximized your ISA allowance, which is £20,000 per year at present, make use of ISAs. So, you know, most platforms have something called the BED and ISA option. So this basis process is just buying, selling shares, investments held outside of the ISA tax-efficient wrapper, and then buying them within the wrapper. The only thing I should mention is that the sale of these assets could trigger a capital gains tax. So you have to look at your circumstances. You have to be aware that that might be the case. But over the long run, making use of ISA shelters and tax wrappers will definitely help you keep more of your cash.
So the best thing would be to do is to do it as soon as possible whilst those allowances, if you're holding investments outside of a tax-free wrapper, is probably to do it now so that you can sort of max out that 12,300 in capital gains.
Exactly. And certainly don't leave it to last minute, because with a lot of investment platforms, these things can take quite some time to facilitate to actually do. And so a lot of investment platforms will have a deadline that's way ahead of the ISA deadline for the tax year, and just to give time for them to actually process the application, the nice application.
Okay. And then once things are in the ISA...
all good. You don't have to worry about capital gains tax or dividend tax. You're all good.
You're all good. And you don't even need to tell the tax man about your ISAs. That's the great thing about them.
That's the beauty about ISAs. It's fantastic.
Yeah, really admin kind of free. Yeah. Okay, so you've got the ISA, and then you've also got SIPs as well, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, you have that tax efficiency. And it's a good thing. You know, you've got the tax relief also, so it's definitely worth having a look if you just want to focus on saving for retirement.
Okay, fine. So with the SIP, and you can put up to £40,000 a year into that.
Yeah, that's right.
Get tax relief, right?
Yeah.
So between the £20,000 in your ISA and the £40,000 that can go into a private pension, you should really be covered by these tax wrappers for most of your investment needs, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, and that, and then of course, with obviously what the Chancellor is doing, and then who knows what they may continue to do. You know, if our finances remain in a dire state,
it could get worse. Well, it's quite interesting. I think there was a lot of talk about changes to the pensions system in the lead up to the statement, and which a lot of pensioners will be a sigh of relief that didn't happen. So things like lowering the lifetime allowance, pension lifetime allowance, which is just above £1 million. There was talk of lowering that threshold, and also there was talks of some serious changes to the pension tax relief treatment, and that didn't happen. But what did happen, which many pensioners will smile about, is a triple lock, the maintenance of the triple lock promise. So that means that those in receipt of state benefits, state pensions, will receive uplift in payments of 10.1%, which is September's inflation figures. So that's a good thing. But it doesn't mean that changes to pensions aren't incoming, I suppose. I know it was early this week or last week, there was stats about the world population, which was quite interesting, and how that's gone up to 8.8 billion people in the world. And a lot of these, it's not because more and more people have been born, although that's the case, but we are living in an increasingly aging society. And if you bring that in context to the UK and the pension triple lock promise, it's just, you know, when you think about that and what that means for that promise, it's looking increasingly likely that something has to change, because if we have an aging population, we already know that that promise is very expensive for the government to maintain. It just suggests that there's going to be some serious changes to pension policy in future. When that will happen remains to be seen.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, because it is quite generous, and as you say, when you sort of got the structure of society is getting older and older and older, and that gets more and more expensive, of course.
Yeah.
So when you're keeping to these kind of quite hefty rises, of course it's going to cost the government quite a lot. And we suspended it last year, so you know, who knows, you know, it could change in the future, right?
Yeah.
Okay, well, on that note, Myron, thank you very much.
No, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Well, a very big thank you to Myron once again for joining me on the podcast. We ran through lots of bits and pieces there. So if you're just looking for a reminder of some of the detail and the implications for savers and investors, then there's my blog at stepstoinvesting.com, which also comes with lots of other videos and blogs and all sorts of things. So please go to that and have a little root around. Next time around, in a fortnight, we're going to be speaking to AJ Bell's pensions expert, a guy called Tom Selby. He has been on the podcast before, and we're going to be running through all the latest themes in the pensions market. So until next time, goodbye.